This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's hard to believe that it's been just a few weeks since the terrible massacre in Las Vegas, and we find ourselves waking up to another similar tragedy. A gunman with an assault weapon fired on a small congregation of Texans praying in their rural church, 26 dead, many more wounded, and again, we hear another chorus of calls for thoughts and prayers in the wake of yet another senseless tragedy.
Well, we add our own thoughts and prayers to the victims of this latest gun violence, which I think we are all shaken by. But as stewards of public health, Mark, I think we are seeking more substantive action. There was a minor attempt after the Las Vegas shootings to regulate a gun product that turns a legal weapon into an illegal automatic weapon, the so-called bump stocks. But even that seems to have fallen by the wayside, to say nothing of more substantive reform.
There are some 33,000 gun-related deaths per year in this country, and in the past year alone, over 300 mass shootings. The crisis calls for decisive policy action, but as we know from experience, crafting such legislation remains a formidable challenge in the current political environment.
You know, Mark, I understand that many of those nearly 600 victims who were wounded and required hospitalization did not have health insurance, and their families have had to kickstart campaigns to help pay for their surgeries and their recovery, just one tragedy compounding another. So we want to take this opportunity to remind people that this year's open enrollment for health coverage is underway right now. It ends in mid-December. Please make sure that you and your family are covered for next year.
There are only a few weeks left of open enrollment for those seeking coverage on the federal exchange. Simply go to healthcare.gov. Here in our state of Connecticut, it's accesshealthct.com. And in your state, there may be a different moniker, but get enrolled. There are specialists available online or on the phone to answer your questions and help you navigate the sites.
And in the meantime, we like to peer into the future and see what kind of trends will be influencing the healthcare of the 21st century. Things like genomics, personalized medicine, and in the case of today's guest, blockchain for healthcare, a secure way of sharing data and currency across connected networks. Still very early stage in healthcare, but some innovators are getting a jump on it as we speak.
And Dr. Sameer Dumani is one of them. He's a cardiologist, researcher, and entrepreneur based at the Scripps Clinic in California, and is the founder of Mint Health, a global personalized electronic health record based on blockchain technology.
And Lori Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Sameer Dumani in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Closing in on a deal. Health insurer Aetna getting closer, reportedly, to finalizing a deal with pharmacy chain giant CVS Health Corp for a merger of the two entities worth about $70 billion. The deal would bring together one of the nation's largest pharmacy benefits entities with one of the nation's longest operating insurance companies. Reuters News cites a source close to the still-secret negotiations. Analysts see this merger as a way to exert more pressure on drug prices, as large pharmacy benefits managers often have the ability to negotiate such prices. The deal is set to be announced in December. The president's trip to Asia sparked a testy back and forth over the role China is playing in the opioid crisis, the administration recently declaring the opioid epidemic a national emergency, with drug overdoses now leading cause of accidental death in this country. Some 20,000 of those, more than 50,000 deaths, blamed on the proliferation of fentanyl into the illicit drug market, an opioid compound that is as much as 100 times more potent than morphine. Drug enforcement experts have long linked the flow of fentanyl into this country from sources in China. China vehemently denying the allegations. Open enrollment underway for insurance coverage for next year under the Affordable Care Act, and consumers are experiencing quite a mixed bag across the country. The uncertain policies regarding the health law coming out of Washington and the president's decision to take away those cost reduction subsidies to insurers to help keep costs down for consumers means many consumers, especially those making too much to qualify for tax breaks, are looking at much higher premiums this year. Open enrollment ends December 15th for consumers in the federal exchanges, while some states with their own marketplaces like Connecticut have extended open enrollment to December 22nd. Meanwhile, the GOP tax reform bill has some measures in it that would impact the health care arena. While it doesn't remove the tax penalty for those who fail to sign up for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, it does call for some other changes, mainly eliminating the tax break for those with high medical expenses due to complex health conditions. The tax credit doesn't apply to a large sector of the population, only those with overall health care costs exceeding 10% of their gross income. But the tax rebates are substantial to those who use them, about $85 billion. And some teens in Arkansas have designed a device that would impact the number of children dying by heat stroke when left inside cars, which kills between 40 to 50 children a year. The ninth grade robotics students from Beebe, Arkansas, have designed a sensor they call Baby Saver 2000, a sensor that can be attached to any baby car seat, which registers the temperature inside a closed car and automatically sets off the panic button on the key fob and also sets off the car's alarm systems. The enterprising teens' invention earned them a $10,000 award. The young entrepreneurs are continuing to develop their prototype for wider testing and distribution. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Samir Damani, founder and CEO of MenHealth, a company utilizing blockchain technology to build a portable, secure, and self-governing personal health record. Dr. Damani is also founder and chief medical and strategy officer of MD Revolution, which aims to build a technology-enabled platform for clinicians working in chronic care management. Dr. Damani earned his Doctor of Pharmacy at the University of Georgia and his MD at Medical College of Georgia. Dr. Damani, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
You know, we're hearing a lot of buzz around the emergence of blockchain technology and its potential game changer. But I think for most people, it's probably still a mystery of what blockchain technology is. But we have many people who are sort of betting on this technology. IBM and Google have pointed to blockchain potential for creating safely encrypted financial transactions, as well as a secure platform for storage and sharing personal health data. And I'm wondering if you might tell our listeners more about this technology, how it works both in theory and practice, and what motivates you to be translating this into the healthcare area.
First of all, you know, trying to understand the problem is, right, before we dive into the actual fix and how blockchain applications can really serve as a solution. I think it's important to understand that 40 of the 56 million annual deaths that occur globally occur from preventable chronic conditions. And what's even more important there is that modifiable risk factors, including obesity, hypertension, sedentary activities, tobacco use, and poor nutrition represent over 70% of the risk for developing and dying from these conditions. And patients today have taken a passive position in their health due to payer and provider kind of dominance and siloed clinical and behavioral data. And so what blockchain enables, it enables a self-sovereign, patient-controlled health record that's tied to a global, unique identifier. It allows for the seamless and secure transfer of clinical and behavioral data between patient-authorized stakeholders. And so, you know, as you think about what is blockchain and why is blockchain relevant, blockchain is essentially a decentralized ledger of all transactions across the peer-to-peer network. And using this technology, any participant can confirm the transactions without the need for any kind of central certifying authority. You or someone requests a transaction or wants to actually transact with another person. Say, I want to transact with you. This requested transaction is actually broadcast to a peer-to-peer network of computers known as nodes. These nodes then validate the transactions and the user status through algorithms. So over a period of 10 minutes, for example, the Bitcoin network processes all these transactions into a block. Then these nodes then validate those transactions every 10 minutes. And typically these blocks have, they're all digits, they're all numbers. And there's a hash that represents the block. And there's a mathematical formula that has to be solved. And that's what this peer-to-peer global network, open source, is actually doing. It's actually validating that algorithm. And that verified transaction involves financial currency, can involve contracts, records, or other information. And then once it's verified, the transaction is combined with these other transactions added as a new block to an existing chain that is completely auditable, open source, and essentially immutable. So if there's a previous block that gets hacked, the blockchain would get essentially disrupted. What this allows is, you know, at least in healthcare, you would have an EHR or some sort of data repository that would be needed in order for patients to get data. But what can happen now is blockchain essentially eliminates the middleman, allows for seamless and secure transfer of data or information. And that gives patients control.
I wonder if you could just focus in on one point for our listeners. We have heard that the stumbling block was the interoperability between systems and overcoming the silos of having this kind of technology. And how does blockchain bypass or overcome the issue of interoperability of records?
No, absolutely. I mean, the data silos that exist today really preclude our ability to deliver personalized care. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, when Mary goes to see her primary care physician, there's data that resides in her EHR at Dr. Jones, but she may see a specialist that has another EHR. Medical imaging might reside in Dr. Jones's separate administrative or medical imaging PAC system server. Then Mary, who's a diabetic and hypertensive patient, probably has her blood pressure written on a sheet, or maybe it's in an app, her step counts in a Fitbit. And so all this data is kind of spread everywhere. And in order to get into these EHRs, you wouldn't even imagine that patients own this data. I mean, because they got to go through this really arduous process of getting all these red tape, administrative kind of bottlenecks to get their own data. And we're still also burning medical imaging on CDs and DVDs. And now you can't even have a single repository, the redundancy of tests that occur. So it's a real mess. And so what basically blockchain would allow is for all these different, you know, health apps, wearables, implants, EHRs, imaging, all of that to be secured in the cloud, tied to a unique identifier that can then be accessed by anyone that the patient deems appropriate and can be written into the blockchain. So we're not trying to replace EHRs. In fact, I spoke with the CEO of a large EHR company. He's like, Samir, the digitization of electronic health records was very important. You had to digitize data. But to move into value-based care, we have to give ownership of the data back to the patient. And that EHRs are really line management software.
Right.
And what really can happen with a blockchain now is Mary can go to Dr. Jones and she'll have an application or platform like MentHealth that would essentially tie her personal record to a cryptographic key. Then Dr. Jones would scan that cryptographic key via an actual QR code. Dr. Jones would then have access to her behavioral information on diet, nutrition, blood pressure, all the things that are behavioral related that are important to her chronic condition. Then 2-3 weeks later, she goes to her cardiologist, Dr. Smith, and he can access any CAT scans or echoes that might have been done at the other site. And at the same time, he scans Mary's cryptographic key. So now Mary now has Dr. Smith's information in her cloud. And over years, you start building this personal cloud storage where medical imaging data, behavioral data, clinical data stays there. And that data can then be moved to anyone and accessed in real time via any kind of mobile web application. And so now you basically can then share that data with whomever you like in real time on the blockchain or through the blockchain. And so the interoperability issues really is solved. You know, EHR companies have really claimed to build these kind of clunky legacy systems in the name of security. But the reality is that they've benefited from having these old legacy right. systems where it makes it difficult for you to pull and push data to it. You know, the beauty is that there are visionary CEOs and that are, you know, really excited about blockchain and see themselves as partnering with physicians and patients to value-based care. And EHRs are going to always be around, but we need patients to have more access to the data. And then you can also layer token mechanisms where now payers and providers can start incentivizing healthy behaviors on behalf of the patient, where they can start getting rewarded and you can start building gamification because these are behavioral conditions.
Well, you certainly are a visionary, and we've had conversations with Eric Topol and Anish Chopra and Todd Park, who all are really in that movement of patients should own their own information. But you've taken it one step further, as I understand it, an app that patients can actually use that will allow them to have control of that. Is that what MnHealth is doing right now?
Yeah, so MnHealth is basically taking blockchain technology and leveraging existing technologies from two companies, MD Revolution. And we've seen, you know, millions of dollars of savings through doing some of the simple behavior like things we talked about. But one of the big things we noticed was that by incentivizing patients, you can get even more benefit from the human interaction that we do today. And, you know, self-monitoring, self-tracking, self-awareness, combined it with human interaction and a clinical tool that sorts data in a way that allows us to engage patients on a very personalized level. The government's done a great job of incenting providers now for non-face-to-face care through these new codes like chronic care management, behavioral health codes, but they're lacking the incentive for the patient. And so what MnHealth is doing is taking existing technology on the patient engagement side, but also taking technology from my co-founder side where they built a actual medical imaging platform where they're able to get medical imaging data from the cloud and render it and stream it instantaneously to an iPad or an iPhone, which has been a huge challenge just because of the size of these images. And so we came together to say, listen, if we could put not just medical imaging in the cloud, but patient data in the cloud, and then layer in, you know, our existing technology, then form a patient engagement model that's tied together by a token called a vitamin, that could be a powerful model, not only for the storage and creating a self-sovereign record for the patient, but also creating a model to drive down the cost of healthcare. I mean, this is a global problem we face. So MnHealth is really bringing together two core technologies from two companies, as well as layering on a blockchain model and a token model to that. And we'll be deploying that to commercial insurance companies who then would essentially use those tokens to incentivize positive patient behaviors to help care for patients with chronic conditions to drive down the cost of care.
Well, Dr. Damani, all of this only works if we can engage patients in being interested in and motivated to change their own behavior. So it seems that the value would be best brought to the entire public as a public utility, a unique identifier like our social security numbers in the U.S., regardless of whatever commercial plan you were with, or just you as an individual could amass the data, because otherwise we always seem to be caught at the bridge where the patient has now changed from one plan to another. What kind of discussions or thoughts are you having with public payers or policymakers about the potential for this as a public utility versus siloed somewhat into individual insurance entities, whether public or private?
The Chronic Care Management Code, which started paying doctors 20 minutes for non-face-to-face care management back in 2015, was the first code ever of its kind to reimburse. It was actually a CMS initiative.
Right,
it was not
right.
An industry-sponsored initiative.
Right,
and
exactly. I was thinking of that as you spoke.
It's a major strategy for them to say, listen, fee-for-service medicine is here to stay, but they want to start incentivizing the right kinds of services, which is why this code was so beautiful. And at $42 a month, you know, it's very difficult to scale that. And so what we did is we saw in a Mississippi population of 3,500 patients that we were able to do a pretty sophisticated case control matching case study and showed that we had about 3.5 million in actual reduction in inpatient hospital claims compared to about the 800,000 that they spent during the 8-month period on the program. So we shared that with CMS and they really loved it. And in our discussion with CMOs of various health plans as well as policy advisors, you know, we've seen an intense amount of interest for anything that is going to get patients to engage. And if you look at the recent MACRA legislation, mm-hmm. you know, which came out in 2015, it was bipartisan. You can actually see that now MIPS, which is the merit-based mm-hmm. incentive payment system, is a system by which anybody who's taking care of Medicare patients, you'll get penalized if you don't have certain metrics and practice improvements or advancing care information or quality. And part of those metrics are engaging patients with preventative and encouraging them to have healthier behaviors. So absolutely. And in fact, we've already started to engage. And as we show early success over the next, you know, call it 12, 18 months, mm-hmm. we definitely have in mind that this would be a platform that the governments, not only of the U.S., but other mm-hmm. countries that are suffering from chronic disease would want to use.
You know, Dr. Damani, I noticed Forbes magazine had 8 reasons to be skeptical of blockchain technology. And one of the statements that they said that because of the inherently distributed peer-to-peer nature, blockchain-based transactions can only complete when all parties update their respective ledgers. People question whether this will bog them down. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about the naysayers about the technology?
There's no question that this technology is going to transform every business that requires a clearinghouse or a middleman. And it's already happening in some cases. And just from things like identifying voters to property ownership, and there's so many things where bottlenecks exist right now because of that, and abuse and fraud occurs because of these central authorities. And so, yes, there are some bottleneck issues. You're right. Mm-hmm. Right now, you know, they can only do a certain amount of transactions per second, but there are new blockchains that are emerging right now, like EOS, which actually is claiming to be able to do 100,000 transactions per second. So there's different ways. There's proof of stake, proof of work concepts in terms of how you actually verify transactions. And there are very innovative models coming out to help verify the transactions at a much more rapid pace. I think right now Ether's at something like 20 or 30 transactions or somewhere in that second. But you're going to see that scale by, you know, in an exponential fashion. But there are some naysayers that say that because they're not really looking at the technology. And we're pretty much at the heart of this because we will be doing a token offering for Mint Health. And so we've got a pretty strong crypto base. We've built out our token mechanisms and are working on the app currently.
Well, I like something that I read where you call it a quiet revolution in healthcare being led not just by the big institutions, but by people themselves, consumers, if you will, certainly with their smartphones and their wearables. It's been just astonishing watching the rise of the use of Fitbit. So it sort of gives us a tremendous amount of data that's kind of all dressed up and ready to go someplace and answer some research questions. But I'm really curious with your background, are you also laying out a research agenda for really trying to identify what does work best and with whom in this patient engagement space? Can we look forward to big contributions to the state of knowledge around what we can do to help patients?
So part of my medical degree, I got a doctorate in pharmacy. And then after doing cardiology, I actually spent almost 4 years doing NIH research, ran multi-million dollar grants. So I got into the MD revolution business around patient engagement with the idea that bringing data together in one place would allow machine learning to really reach the promise that we've been kind of pushing for so long, but we haven't because the data has been so scattered and siloed. And I think the reality in this situation where you have this personal cloud storage that's protected by the blockchain, but has medical imaging, has the clinical and behavioral information, and also the EHR information in one place that the patient can share. Now, you have a way that not only are you enabling a central repository, but you're allowing patients to then decide. And we have a very unique mechanism where we're going to allow patients to vote on the way they can use the data. So if pharma wants to know all the diabetics who are on a certain drug and what their response has been, patients can now volunteer to share that data using the Mint Health application. So research and academic institutions, pharma, med device, genetic companies would be very interested because one of the problems with data is that it's broad and very shallow. But what we really need is deep data and broad data. And you can no longer in the spirit or name of security say, we can't give you your data, you know, and that's the beauty of the blockchain atmosphere is it's immutable and it's open source. So you can see everyone that's accessed anything ever. So the answer to that is absolutely. The ability to gather the data allows for machine learning to really reach its full potential, really trying to predict who's going to have an outcome or who's more likely to not follow direction, and that requires deep data.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Samir Damani, practicing cardiologist at Scripps Clinic and Scripps Research Institute, and founder and CEO of Mint Health, a company that utilizes blockchain technology to build a portable, secure, and self-governed personal health record. You can learn more about his work by going to minthealth.io. Dr. Damani, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Senator Rand Paul claimed that the National Institutes of Health provided $2 million for a study on whether, quote, kids don't like food that has been sneezed on. That misrepresents the research. The $2 million went to a six-year project composed of multiple studies on children's reasoning about foods. One study used a video of an actor sneezing on food as a means of understanding if young children can pick up on subtle cues about contamination. Paul also ignored the ultimate aim of the NIH research, to contribute to developing ways to nudge kids to make safer and more healthy food choices by understanding why they make certain choices to begin with. The senator made the claim while advocating legislation he introduced to change the federal grant funding process. We take no position on whether or not the federal government should have funded this research project, but the NIH didn't spend the money to figure out if people don't like food that has been sneezed on. Among the studies in the overall project was one to understand whether kids of various ages can pick up on subtle cues about contamination. It was done by two professors studying social cognition at Cornell and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The study didn't find that people are less likely to choose food that has been sneezed on. As Paul said, that might be the case for adults, but the picture is more complicated with children. The kids were shown a video that led them to believe that a blue bowl would contain clean applesauce and a red bowl would contain sneezed on or contaminated applesauce. The researchers found that 57% of the 3 to 8-year-olds ate from both bowls and 28% only ate from the clean bowls. 3 to 4-year-olds also ate significantly more contaminated food and rated it tastier. The researchers concluded that subtle cues can effectively impact children's choice, consumption, and evaluation of otherwise identical foods, but that influence differs by age. Future research is needed, they said, quote, to understand the scope of context that might either decrease or heighten children's sensitivity to contamination. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Soaring prescription drug prices have been taking a toll on American health consumers. But until now, most didn't understand that they might actually have some say in what their prescription drugs cost them. Many Americans have resorted to purchasing prescriptions online, often illegally or overseas. While cheaper, these solutions come with their own risk. So an enterprising pair of brothers have created their own solution. Matthew and Jeffrey Chaikin founded Blink Health, a free online destination that links patients with prescription sources that can be up to 90% cheaper than what's found on the traditional market.
The way it works is you go to blinkhealth.com, you look up the name of your medication, the price you see there is the price you get at over 60,000 pharmacies nationwide. If that price is less than what you normally pay for your prescription, you pay for it online. We provide you with what we call a digital Blink pharmacy card. You show that card to the pharmacist, they type in the codes on that card, and your medication rings up as $0.
Co-founder Jeffrey Chaikin to CBS News recently, they negotiated prices directly with drug manufacturers.
We actually have contracts with every single pharmacy in the United States. So what the nature of the contract is that they accept our prices. So we have different prices at each pharmacy, but what's important for consumers is that when they go to Blink, there's one price that they're going to see. They'll get that price no matter which pharmacy they go to.
The Chaikin brothers say the element that makes it work so well is customers can purchase the drugs online, but still pick them up at their trusted local pharmacy. Since Blink launched last year, users have saved millions of dollars on prescriptions, and a majority of those prescriptions are filled for $10 or less. A welcome reality at a time when not only drug prices are going up, but co-pays and out-of-pocket costs are rising dramatically as well. Blink, an online site for purchasing prescription drugs, offering consumers an option to safely fill prescriptions at a far more competitive price than the going rate, allowing them to stay healthy and save significant money at the same time. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.